Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you're in aviation maintenance today, well, you're standing right at a critical point, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. It's this convergence of the traditional hands-on mechanical skills we've relied on for decades.
Right, the real craft of it.
Exactly. And now you've got these rapidly evolving digital technologies. Think AI, predictive analytics, automated monitoring. It's all flooding in.
It creates this kind of paradox, doesn't it? The systems are getting incredibly complex, almost mind-bogglingly so. But the human element, the actual technician on the floor, they're still the most crucial asset. They're the final decision maker.
Yeah, and we're asking them to do this constant mental switch. One minute it's physical dexterity, the next it's interpreting complex data streams. It's a really intense hybrid environment.
So yeah, that's really what we're diving into today. We want to give you, our listeners, a kind of shortcut to understanding this new cognitive landscape.
Making sense of the blend.
Exactly. We've pulled together insights from some really key voices in the industry. We're synthesizing perspectives from people like Michael Parrish at Elliott Aviation, Dr. Antonio Cortez from GMR Human Performance, Jonathan Huff, who's with TeamViewer, and also Dr. Philip Jasper from JS Held.
A great lineup.
We want to unpack the key risks, yes, but also the opportunities. What happens when the wrench really meets the algorithm?
And I think the place to start is looking beyond just sort of physical safety dropping tools or whatnot, and really focusing on the architecture of cognitive safety. How do we support the thinking process?
Okay, let's start right there then. Because the biggest shift seems to be towards predictive safety, doesn't it?
Definitely.
We're talking about integrating things like fatigue risk management systems, FRMS, into the bigger safety management system, the SMS.
Right. And that fundamentally shifts human factors management. It moves away from just investigating after something goes wrong
Reactive.
to trying to prevent it proactively. It's about prevention.
So how does that work in practice? How do these systems help?
Well, it's really about bringing in science and data. Michael Parrish from Elliott Aviation, he makes a strong point here. He says automated FRMS are essential because they provide that data-driven science.
Okay.
Better planning, better staffing, all within that SMS framework we just mentioned. But, and this is crucial, he's very quick to add that these systems are tools.
Just tools.
Tools to enhance planning. They absolutely do not and should not replace human supervision or that final human judgment call.
Got it. So FRMS focuses on fatigue. What specifically are we trying to stop fatigue from doing? What's the core risk?
Dr. Antonio Cortez, he's with GMR Human Performance. He explains it very clearly. FRMS is there to prevent the impairment of human performance caused by fatigue.
Impairment-like.
Well, fatigue leads to some really core human errors. Things like cognitive fixation, he calls it, channeled attention, or
Like
tunneling.
tunnel vision.
Exactly. Where you get locked onto one thing and miss something critical on the periphery. And also just increased distraction. Simple mistakes happen when you're tired.
Makes sense. And what are the main drivers of that kind of safety critical fatigue?
Dr. Cortez points to three big ones that a good FRMS needs to tackle. First, simple sleep loss, not getting enough restorative sleep.
Okay.
Second, circadian misalignment. That's basically working against your natural body clock, like on night shifts or with irregular schedules.
Right, jet lag for maintainers almost.
Sort of, yeah. And third, just plain excessive workload. Too much to do in too little time, or tasks that are too demanding for too long. The tech helps spot those high-risk windows before the fatigue really sets in and causes impairment.
But hang on, the tech only works if people are honest, right? If they actually report feeling fatigued or if the system's data is accurate.
You've hit on a critical point. This brings in what Dr. Cortez really emphasizes, the absolute need for just culture.
Okay, just culture. For listeners maybe less deep in aviation safety jargon, what does that mean practically?
It means creating an environment, a culture, where everyone, pilots, engineers, maintainers, whoever, feels safe. Safe reporting errors, near misses, or system issues.
Like being overly tired.
Exactly. Without fearing they're going to get blamed unfairly or punished disproportionately. It's about the organization learning from mistakes or system strains, not just pointing fingers.
I think that anecdote Dr. Cortez shared really drives this home. Didn't he mention a software engineer?
Oh, yeah, the O versus Zero story. It's a classic.
I lost that one.
Okay, so this engineer, completely exhausted, was coding, and they typed the letter O instead of the number zero. Tiny mistake, right?
Seems minor.
But in this critical piece of code, that one character typo triggered, I think he said, 5 days of absolute chaos. Just unnecessary rework, hunting down a phantom bug, all because of exhaustion leading to a simple slip.
Wow. Okay, so that tiny error magnified by fatigue.
Precisely. That's the kind of systemic hazard we want to catch. And that's why Dr. Cortes insists that integrating FRMS data directly into the existing SMS hazard reporting process isn't just nice to have, it's non-negotiable.
Why integrate it so tightly? Why not a separate fatigue report?
Because the SMS already has the established structure. It's got the procedures, crucially, the identity protection measures, the things that guarantee a just culture approach. That encourages people to actually use the system and voluntarily report fatigue concerns.
Okay, that makes sense. But I'm still wondering, if we've got machine learning crunching data, wearables tracking biometrics, even weather data feeding into fatigue prediction, why is there still so much talk about, well, low-tech stuff?
Like the buddy system.
Yeah. Does the buddy system really stand up against an AI algorithm?
It's a fantastic question. And the experts we looked at really stress it's not either. It has to be a hybrid approach.
Okay.
Dr. Cortes reminds us, technology is just one layer of defense. You absolutely still need the fundamentals. Clear policies on work rest cycles, for instance.
Yeah.
Total basics. Staying hydrated sounds simple, but dehydration impacts cognition. Implementing structured double-checking procedures for critical tasks. And yes, using a buddy system.
So colleagues looking out for each other.
Exactly. So colleagues can spot fatigue symptoms in each other that maybe the individual themselves doesn't even recognize. You know, hey, man, you look beat. Maybe take five. That kind of thing.
So high tech predicts and plans. Low tech provides that real time human check. Okay. Now, Jonathan Huff from TeamViewer, he brings the tech side back into focus. He insists FRMS has to be inside the SMS, right? As an enabler.
Yes. Not just running alongside it in a silo.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be integrated. And this is where technology like augmented reality, AR, TeamViewer Frontline really comes into play.
How so?
Huff explains that when you pair FRMS data with AR-enabled workflows, those fatigue signals aren't just logged somewhere passively. They become active contextual inputs, meaning if the system flags a high fatigue window for a technician, the AR workflow itself can adapt. It might automatically add an extra verification step or suggest calling in a remote expert for a quick consult.
Ah, okay. And Huff laid out some pretty specific design rules for how those alerts should work, didn't he? From a human factors perspective.
He did. Very important points. Alerts have to be concise, relevant, no alert fatigue from constant, useless notifications.
Right.
But maybe the most critical human factors principle he mentioned is preserving the technician's control, their agency. The system shouldn't just enforce a hard lockout like, you're too tired, go home.
Because that could be counterproductive or frustrating.
Totally. Instead, a fatigued technician should have options. Maybe request that remote expert easily through the AR interface, or follow a specific mitigative workflow that mandates, say, a second sign-off. Give them control within safe boundaries.
It really seems like designing the safety tech is only one piece. We also have to design for how the human mind processes all this new information, which leads us right into cognitive workload.
Exactly. Section 2, and this is a huge transition we're seeing. The technician's actual job description is fundamentally changing.
How so?
It's shifting from purely physical skills, important as they still are, towards much more digital interaction. Troubleshooting software, interpreting complex data sets.
Michael Parrish at Elliott Aviation, he described it as technicians needing to span different types of thinking, right? Moving from physical work to analysis, making decisions based on what the technology is telling them.
It's like an intellectual juggling act.
Yeah.
And Dr. Philip Jasper from J.S. Helbitt, he puts a specific term on this. Dual task demands. You're managing the physical task, say, on the aircraft wing, while simultaneously interacting with a tablet or AR display.
And that splits your attention.
It leads to task fragmentation, he says. And that significantly increases the mental workload, the cognitive load.
So this is where the design of the automation itself becomes absolutely critical. We tend to assume tech always reduces workload, but that's not necessarily true, is it?
Not at all. It depends entirely on how it's designed. Dr. Jasper draws a really sharp distinction here. Well-designed automation that can ease workload. It intelligently takes over routine, repetitive stuff.
Okay, the grunt work.
Right. But poorly designed systems, the ones that need constant babysitting, endless pop-ups to click through, confusing menus, they can actually increase the technician's workload.
So the tool becomes another problem to manage.
Exactly. Helpful automation turns into just another cognitive burden.
Can you give us a quick, concrete example? What might a poorly designed system look like on the hangar floor?
Okay, imagine a system meant to guide a maintenance procedure. Instead of just clearly showing the next step, Maybe a bad system forces the tech to click OK on three different warning pop-ups.
Annoying.
Then check off four separate digital boxes, then input some data into a really clunky tablet interface, all before they can actually pick up the tool and do the physical task. That constant switching back and forth, the unnecessary clicks, it fragments their focus and adds a ton of stress.
So the answer isn't just throwing more tech at the problem. It's about minimizing that cognitive tax the interface imposes.
Precisely. Dr. Jasper emphasizes thoughtful interface design, intuitive layouts, clear information hierarchy things that minimize cognitive load, and also simulation-based training.
Training for what specifically?
Training that specifically prepares technicians for that transition, smoothly moving between the digital instructions or data and the hands-on manual work and back again, practicing that hybrid workflow.
And Jonathan Huff, coming back to AR, he clarifies its role here too, right? AR doesn't necessarily eliminate the thinking.
No, but it redistributes and refines it, as he puts it. It takes the burden off your fragile human working memory, things like needing to remember the exact torque value
right.
or finding page 347 in the manual.
The AR system handles that lookup test.
Right. It shifts that routine information retrieval away from the human brain.
So AR isn't making the job thoughtless. It's changing what you need to think about. How does that keep the technician as the critical decision maker?
Because by offloading that memory burden, the technician can focus their limited cognitive resources on the stuff that really matters: contextual intelligence, critical judgment, troubleshooting the unexpected, things AI can't do.
They focus on the how and the why, not just the what and the where of the manual.
You got it. They become the overseer, the critical thinker, supported by the tech.
Which brings us neatly to the biggest cognitive challenge of all, perhaps. AI, predictive maintenance, and that ever-present risk of human bias when we deal with smart machines.
Yeah, section three. The promise here is huge, right? AI predicting component failure before it actually happens.
The holy grail for maintenance planning.
Absolutely. Yeah. But as Dr. Jasper points out, this profoundly shifts the technician's role again. They move from being a hands-on problem solver,
finding the existing fault,
to becoming an interpreter of probabilistic data.
That sounds fundamentally different. Why is interpreting probability so much harder?
Well, because it's dealing with uncertainty, inherently. The system isn't saying this part is broken. It's saying there's an 85% probability of failure in system X within the next 50 flight hours.
So you have to weigh that uncertainty.
Exactly. You have to interpret confidence levels. And, of course, you still have that classic human factors issue, alert fatigue. If the system cries wolf too often with low probability warnings, people just start ignoring it.
It's fascinating how Dr. Cortez connects our enthusiasm for AI directly back to basic human psychology. We get caught up in the hype.
Yeah, he points out that discussions often focus on the flashy AI outputs, the amazing predictions, while kind of ignoring the subtle human thinking traps that come with it.
Like what?
He mentioned two key biases. First, novelty bias. We're naturally drawn to the new shiny thing, the AI insight, and we might subconsciously downplay older, established diagnostic methods that are still valid.
Okay, chasing the new tech.
And second, the availability heuristic. We judge how important or likely something is based on how easily we can recall an example. So if the AI made a brilliant prediction that saved the day last week,
we're more likely to trust it blindly this week.
Exactly. Even if the circumstances are different, our judgment gets skewed by that readily available success story.
And connecting this back to the system itself, Dr. Cortez gave us a crucial reminder, didn't he? Something often forgotten in the race for AI.
Yes, a fundamental truth. AI's fuel is data. Predictive excellence depends entirely, 100%, on certified data quality.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Poor quality data, incomplete data, biased data, it will inevitably lead to inaccurate, confusing, or dangerously misleading AI output. Focusing on data integrity, data fidelity. That's step one, often overlooked.
And then we have the classic cognitive traps that automation seems to amplify. Michael Parrish detailed a couple of common risks right there in the hangar.
Yeah, the big ones. Automation bias. That default assumption that the complex system must be correct, overriding your own judgment, the computer says.
Right. And confirmation bias, where you subconsciously look for, or overweight, data that confirms what you already suspect or your own experience tells you, and you underweight conflicting data, even if it comes from the AI.
So how do organizations fight these natural human tendencies?
Structured solutions are key. Parrish stresses that training is vital, but not just training on how to use the AI tool. Training must focus on teaching technicians to critically evaluate the data, to question the AI, and to treat its insights as just one important input among many.
It informs, it doesn't dictate.
That's the goal. And Jonathan Huff adds a few more cognitive pitfalls that AI can introduce or worsen.
Such as?
Things like anchoring bias. The AI gives a recommendation, and that initial suggestion kind of anchors your thinking, making it harder to consider alternatives, even if other signs point elsewhere.
You get stuck on the first idea.
Uh-huh. Then there's authority bias.
Yeah.
We tend to trust perceived authorities, and a sophisticated AI system can feel like an authority, leading to blind trust.
And finally, the framing effect. How the AI presents the information, maybe as a stark warning icon versus a neutral percentage, can significantly influence the technician's decision, even if the underlying data is the same.
Wow. So AI makes us potentially faster, more predictive, but if we're not careful, it just gives us faster ways to fall into old human error traps like blind trust and tunnel vision.
That's the risk, yeah.
So what's the essential difference? What defines the successful future relationship between the human expert and the AI tool?
Huff provides that really core distinction, I think. AI excels at speed, recognizing complex patterns in massive data sets, crunching numbers tirelessly.
What humans are bad at.
Often, yeah. But human experts provide the irreplaceable stuff. Contextual intelligence, intuition built on years of experience, adaptability to novel situations, common sense reasoning. Things AI fundamentally lacks.
So the path forward isn't AI or human, it's designing the team. Dr. Jasper outlined how that collaboration needs to be structured.
Right. First, AI system design has to promote transparency, the black box problem. The technician needs some understanding of why the AI made a particular prediction, not just what the prediction is. Explainability is key.
So you can sanity check it.
Exactly. Second, organizations absolutely need clear escalation protocols. What happens when the experienced technician's gut feeling or contextual knowledge directly conflicts with the AI's recommendation? There needs to be a process.
A way to resolve the conflict safely.
Precisely. The ultimate goal, Dr. Jasper says, is creating these structured human AI teams. The machine provides the speed, the scale, the data processing power.
And the human provides the context, the experience, the critical judgment, the adaptability.
That's the synergy we need to aim for.
So wrapping this all up, What does this mean for you, the maintainer, listening today? Our deep dive into these sources really reveals that the future isn't about choosing between human skill and technology. It's not a zero-sum game.
No, it's about mandatory integration, finding that optimal blend, safety, efficiency. All the advances happen when these systems are designed to enhance and support human judgment, not replace it.
And crucially, when those cognitive biases that are just part of being human are acknowledged up front and strategically addressed in the system design and the training.
We have to be really mindful of that critical cognitive shift we talked about. The technician, make no mistake, remains the absolute guardian of flight safety. That doesn't change.
Still the last line of defense.
Always. But the new core challenge is mastering that mental shift from primarily being a hands-on problem solver to also being a sophisticated interpreter of uncertain probabilistic data. Learning how to think in concert with these powerful new digital partners.
That leads us to a final provocative thought for you to mull over. If this new core requirement is contextual judgment, especially when facing uncertain data from AI, what existing traditional hands-on skill that a seasoned maintainer already possesses? You know, that deep, almost intuitive, embodied knowledge, what part of that is most transferable to this new world?
What deep-seated skill best prepares them to apply that critical contextual judgment, maybe even to challenge the machine when necessary?
That's a great question. Something to think about. We'll leave you with that. See you in the next deep dive.